Your call is now live.
Morning, everyone. This is Michelle Sinikowski, Policy Analyst at Leading Age New York, formerly NIASA. Welcome to our audio conference entitled Best Practice, Medical Direction, and Medical Care in Skilled Nursing Facilities. Before we begin the program, there are a few housekeeping details to review. The email you received from us last week included a conference packet. The packet includes the handout for today's session with the presentation slides and a seminar evaluation form. There is no NAB credit available for today's presentation. Please complete the evaluation form and fax it to Nancy Knapp at the number provided at the bottom of the form. This audio conference is sponsored by the Empire Quality Partnership. The Empire Quality Partnership is a collaboration of provider associations, CCLC, ANES, Leading Edge New York, and NISHVA. The partnership was created to serve as New York's local area network for excellence, which is also referred to as a LANE, for the National Advancing Excellence Campaign. As a New York State LANE convener, the partnership provides information, resources, and tools from the national campaign to New York's nursing home providers to assist with quality improvement priorities. Each year, the partnership sets goals related to the promotion of quality care in our state's nursing homes. This year's goals include making advancements in person-centered care, reducing the incidence of pressure ulcers, and increasing staff satisfaction. We are pleased to have been part of the development of the medical direction guidelines. These medical direction guidelines are consistent with many other important activities that long-term care providers and clinicians are already engaged in. And we believe that the guideline recommendations can be streamlined into many of your existing activities. For example, these guidelines are consistent with current federal and state requirements for activities that clinicians are already involved in related to the MDS, diagnosis, assessment, and goal setting, as well as state survey requirements for comprehensive care planning to ensure necessary care to achieve the highest practical well-being for the residents. The guidelines support the advancement of person-centered care, culture change, and evidence-based programs to prevent unnecessary hospitalizations, such as the INTERACT initiative. Many of these initiatives are directly supported by Advancing Excellence's resources, goals, and programs. The partnership team encourages you to enroll today in the campaign if you are not already enrolled. Our program today will help you understand the intent of the new guidelines and how to use them as a best practice. It will assist you to evaluate the need to reassess the culture and medical practice of your facility and to begin to formulate a plan to incorporate the guidelines into practice. Our speakers today are Dr. Beth Dichter, Dr. Evelyn Dooley-Seidman, and Mr. Andy Cruikshank. Beth Dichter, PhD, has directed the Bureau of Credentialing in the newly formed Center for Healthcare Quality and Surveillance, New York State Department of Health, since 2006. She is also the Executive Secretary to the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators. Drs. Dichter and Gelman led the initiative to develop the guidelines on medical direction and medical care in nursing homes. Dr. Dooley is a long-term care consultant, chair of the MSSNY Subcommittee on Long-Term Care Quality Committee, has served as medical director in long-term care and geriatrics at Brookdale Hospital Medical Center for 30 years, and most recently was involved with defense litigation representing nursing homes and hospitals. Mr. Cruikshank has served as the CEO of Fort Hudson Health System in Fort Edward since 2000. Fort Hudson offers skilled nursing, inpatient rehab, licensed home care, service coordination, integrated medical and social adult daycare programs, and market-rate senior housing. Mr. Cruikshank is a registered nurse, licensed nursing home administrator, and has a master's degree in health administration. Beth, we leave it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Michelle. Before we get into how we develop the guidelines and what they need to do to implement them, we thought we'd give you a bit of background on why we developed them. In the summer of 2010, the Department of Health joined with the New York Medical Directors Association to address what we thought was a significant quality of care issue in nursing homes, and that is the suboptimal medical direction and medical care. We formed, with NIMDA, we formed a work group to take a first step in addressing this issue. We invited people from NIMDA, Dr. Leonard Gelman, the American Medical Directors Association, the Medical Society of the State of New York, the American Geriatric Society, most of the nursing home associations in the state, and medical directors and attending medical practitioners from nursing homes across the state. And we also invited nurse practitioners to participate. We had a couple of members on the work group from the Board of Examiners of Nursing Home Administrators, and we also reached out to the SUNY School of Public Health to join the work group. The charge to the work group, and we're on slide 2 now, is to improve the health outcomes and quality of life for nursing home residents by strengthening medical direction and medical care through the provision of written guidance and model policies and procedures for credentialing, the qualifications, roles, responsibilities, and accountabilities of medical directors, and the roles, responsibilities, and accountabilities of attending physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants. So this is the charge to the work group. It had a year to develop the guidelines, and it came up with the guidelines. It finished them in under a year. The guidelines and best practices are process-oriented. They are not clinical. They incorporate regulatory requirements, but they go beyond them. While implementation is voluntary, there are many reasons why we think nursing homes should implement these guidelines. And we're now on slide 2. I have to get to slide 2. Well, maybe somebody else could get to that. Okay. There are many values to these guidelines, including they will help you, your medical director, attending practitioners, and nursing staff provide optimal medical care. This will lead to better health and quality of life outcomes for your residents, which in turn produces greater resident and family satisfaction with care in the facility as a whole, greater staff satisfaction with and pride in the quality of care that they provide to your residents, an enhanced reputation in your community for providing high-quality care, and fewer emergency room visits and hospitalizations. The guidelines reflect team-based care planning and delivery and quality improvement. They also support person-centered planning. This will help your facility be successful during the new QIS, the key surveys that are being implemented across the state. The guidelines will help you provide better and more timely medical care, which will lead to fewer crises and fewer preventable ER visits and hospitalizations. They will help your facility to provide the quality care and positive health outcomes that all stakeholders are now demanding. And they will help you define performance expectations sought by Medicare Advantage plans that enroll your residents. They will also strengthen your facility's capacity to function effectively and successfully in healthcare reform, both in Medicaid's managed care environment and Medicaid's and Medicare's coordinated and integrated care environment. And finally, they will reduce your facility's exposure to litigation. We think these guidelines are going to be such useful tools to you in the future, in the very near future, that we didn't think we needed them to be a regulatory initiative. These are some of the tools that the department is partnering with the industry to develop for the industry to help you survive and thrive in managed care. And we're now going to slide 4, and Dr. Pat Dooley will take it from here.
Thank you very much, Beth, and good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is an exciting opportunity to be part of a unique project, unique because it comes from provider sections, and it's a challenge, and it will work if we're all a team. I might add on the background, we did an exhaustive nationwide search of practices in other states We looked at extensive research published, and we held medical culture change workshops and affinity exercises in the process of reaching the guidelines as you have received for this conference. And just a little history, quality medical care, and this program concerns medical care, the role of medical directors and physicians in care in nursing homes. The quality of care has long been a subject of concern, criticism, media publication, and that's been going on for decades. And there have been several attempts to improve the care. Going back to the 1970s, Medicare required physicians, medical directors to be in all skilled nursing facilities in the country, nationally. In 1987, OBRA passed the Nursing Home Reform Act that stipulated the dual function of medical directors, number one, implementation of resident care policies, and number two, coordination of care within the facility. And in and we go to slide number four. In 2001, the Institute of Medicine conducted a study on improving quality of care in nursing homes. And they found that medical directors had overall responsibility for medical care, but very little authority to carry out those responsibilities, and there was little accountability of attending physicians to the medical director. And so based on that, they recommended, made several recommendations. They recommended that medical directors be given more authority, and also that medical care practitioners be accountable to the medical director for the care they provided. If you look at slide four, this is a verbatim recommendation from that Institute of Medicine study, that nursing homes should develop structures and processes that enable and require a more focused and dedicated medical staff responsible for patient care. And those processes included credentialing, looking at someone's background, qualifications, licensure, and expertise, peer review, the evaluation of how well that practitioner's medical care has been provided, and accountability of attending physicians in nursing homes to the medical director. And finally, in 2005, the federal government revised FTAG 501 that relates to medical directorship. And the changes included making the resident care policies more specific. It enumerated all of them. And it also emphasized that the medical director was responsible for the overall quality of care in nursing homes. And secondly, that care coordination had to ensure the appropriateness of the care provided. That was slide four and five. In slide five, when addressing expertise needed by medical staff in nursing homes, it was emphasized that geriatric training is especially important. And I might also add certification that is currently given by the American Medical Directors Association for medical directors is strongly recommended. Staffing studies have been done, and in 1997, two researchers from the University of Rochester published this study, which claimed that medical practitioners with primarily a nursing home practice spent a mere 2 hours a week in the nursing home. In 2009, and this is not on your slide, a second study that was published in JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Directors Association, had increased that time spent in nursing homes to 8 hours a week. And certainly it seems a low number for all of the responsibilities that have to be carried out. So the in view of the fact that our current population, as you know, has changed dramatically in the last three decades, our population in nursing homes has become increasingly frail, medically complex, has a variety of other issues now, psychosocial and mental health needs. So it's a difficult type of medicine to practice, and it requires a specific expertise from all those caregivers. So our work group devised a plan to look at the current status of medical care provided. That was our starting point. And we looked at, number one, what works in nursing homes that work well, and also what does not work. And these items that are listed on slides 7, 8, 9, and 10, and 11, come directly from providers in nursing homes, other medical directors, and others involved in the oversight of medical care, administrators, nursing, et cetera. And this is what was found. What works, and you're not surprised at this, good care planning meetings, physician extenders, review of how care is provided by practitioners, communication, especially with residents, with other staff members, care planning that incorporates residents' needs as well as expectations and advance directives, and the communication through electronic health records, which is not yet fully implemented in all nursing homes. Physicians who have a full-time presence was thought to be a major positive factor, and frequent regular visits, so continuity of care is maintained. Teamwork was especially important, and the changes in the CMS guidelines that occurred with the revision of FTED 501 that I mentioned in 2005 has helped to strengthen the role of medical directors. Also, ongoing education within the facility is extremely important for raising expertise of all staff, and in the process of that, improving quality of care. Having access to current guidelines and standards is also educational and important. It was mentioned the use of a transition care coordinator between settings. We all know what happens on transfer in and out of facilities, that information can get missed and or eliminated or not included, and hence quality of care is affected. So we go to what we discovered when we asked what doesn't work in nursing homes, and this listing is three times longer than what does work. So just to summarize it, what doesn't work starts with communication at all levels, between staff, communication with residents, communication with management. Good communication works, but if there is a lack of good communication or adequate communication, care is affected. Care review, is documentation in order? Has there been inappropriate care delivered? Has care been excessive? Or too many tests ordered, too many medications given, or have outcome measures been looked at and achieved? This is all incorporated into care review. Attitudes are important. Negative attitudes affect how staff render care. And they can relate to a negative attitude about regulations, administration not involved in how medical care is provided or how good it is, and also last but not least among attitudes is the relationship that the medical staff has with nursing staff. It should be one of mutual respect, and it should be one of eagerly seeking out the opinion of other professional staff, especially when it comes to clinical decision making. If systems are poor, you won't get your lab results on time. If physicians claim there is a lack of time to be spent in the facility, that too affects the care and also contributes to increasing the stress level within the facility. Poor care planning, inadequate credentialing, and a lack of education all contribute to this. And that brings us to slide 12. And some of this you can read. But slide 12 delineates the beliefs that we were able to ascertain that contribute to this behavior. And it goes, again, to general groups. No quality assurance, a quality assurance perceived as not available, not being used, of no value. Care planning conferences, again, the belief that these are not worthwhile and are not necessary. The attitudes of professionals, that defensive medicine is fine. It's okay to order tests or medications because you want to protect yourself rather than looking at what is the correct indication for writing this order, for placing an individual on a medication. And so the time element is very important in the beliefs. Many physicians feel that you don't need to spend a lot of time in nursing homes, that it's a low-stress, low-paying environment. All you have to do is sign off on orders, and that the care provided is unskilled care. So these are all concepts and beliefs that really are amenable to change if the level of quality of care that we provide is to be changed. So I'd like you to go to slide 15 now. And this study, again, was done by the same two researchers, the University of Rochester, and published in JAMDA in 2006. And it linked the presence of physicians to outcomes in a nursing home. And that study found that there are many beneficial effects: appropriate use of services, timely assessment, being available for the management of acute issues, interaction with staff, serving as role models, participation in committee work. All of these were very positive, and it is defined. So at this point, after looking at research, after searching practices in other states, after holding culture change workshops and affinity exercises, the work group came to the realization that in order to change quality of care, we must change the culture. And so a culture of accountability was looked at. Much has been published about this. There is a reference journey to the Emerald City by these two authors, Connors and Smith, and who define that in a culture of accountability, people think and act in a manner necessary for their organization to achieve results, and that it's a place where everyone continually asks, what else can I do to achieve results, attain objectives, accomplish goals, and the bottom line is provide the best possible care for the residents. A culture change has four steps, and I refer you to slide 18. The four steps to accountability: see it, own it, solve it, and do it. And I'll give you an example. A medical director is informed that on a resident admitted for rehab, 3 to 4 weeks into the admission, develops a pressure ulcer. So there are two events that have to occur. Number one is addressing the acute problem of the ulcer, and we know what goes into that. It's not only the treatment of the ulcer, but it's also ensuring that there is a prevention plan to stop further deterioration or prevent other ulcers from developing. And in the course of doing that, hopefully the cause for the development of that ulcer is identified. Where did the system break down? Now, from a medical director's standpoint, and this could also be in the mind of a cognizant, accountable physician, well, you would ask, are there any other residents in-house who came in with no pressure ulcers and then developed them? And so a look at the facility system for managing pressure ulcers or preventing them comes onto the to-do list of the medical director, starting with looking at risk assessment, going through care planning and prevention of pressure ulcers and management and treatment. So there is a short-term intervention here, but there's also, in a culture of accountability, there should be a long-term look at the facility in general for this particular system. The medical director should come up with, take responsibility for this issue that arose, determine how to solve it, set in place the plan, and she does not do this alone. This is in collaboration with the team, and come back and ensure on follow-up that the plan has been implemented. That is what happens in a culture of accountability. So we've looked at the current system, and we decided what to do, what change is necessary. And now we look at, in a culture of accountability, that would be the new culture. What would we expect? And I refer you to slides 20 and 21, the results expected, and they follow those deficiencies that were found in facilities that do not work well. And slide 20, we would expect improved communication, shared responsibility, systems-type thinking, like I mentioned with the pressure ulcer case, improved documentation, which would translate into decreased hospitalizations and readmissions, reducing the stress by fewer crises occurring. Hopefully, continuity of care would be achieved, more effective care planning, and with that decrease in staff turnover and enhanced satisfaction with their position in the nursing facility. And so clinical outcomes would be expected to improve, and the use of statistical data is expected to increase. And with those expectations would come enhanced skills that we would expect for administrators. We would expect administrators to accept and understand the need for definitive expectations for medical directors and attending physicians, that these be in writing and communicated, shared with other staff in the facility, and that there would be a particular value placed on the need for communication, and we would expect administrators to be role models for other department heads and for other staff. And for physicians, we would expect these physician skills to improve in communication, in the ability to diagnose correctly, which is so important, deal better with families and with residents when it comes to explaining various and uncertain aspects of care that they're not sure of. Better use of medications, greater ability to act on evidence and respond to acute situations. And for medical directors, we would expect them to assume a greater leadership role to improve their communication skills and to become integrated in the philosophy of a facility, of their facility, by participating in education and by being present. And for the facility itself, we would expect an enhanced use of information technology, greater expansion of palliative care, and a greater focus on meeting all of the needs of the residents and not just a limited number, and greater coordination with hospitals. And I refer you now to slide 27, which describes the belief the new culture will have. And a leadership team is number one. A systems approach is number two. And education, number three. And we should all have the philosophy that residents deserve the best possible care that we can provide, and it should be appropriate and correct care, and that is a right of the resident. We anticipate and believe that there should be stronger relationships between the community resource centers, hospitals and physicians and specialists, et cetera, and that leaders in nursing homes are committed to create an environment in which all staff incorporate a new information technology. And this new culture will have nursing homes and medical practitioners recognizing and accepting the value of evidence-based and cost-effective interventions and medical care viewed with the same respect and regard as medical care delivered in any other setting. And also that there would be a value placed on the right of each resident and proxy in care planning, and that we would create a more home-like and less institutional environment. And so these guidelines incorporate regulations, roles, a change in culture, but the outcome will be an improvement in the medical care provided. Thank you very much for your attention, and I now turn it over to Andy for the rest of the discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dooley, and good morning to everyone participating today. I will tell you, first of all, it was a privilege to work with this work group, and from a provider standpoint, I really saw a wide cross-section of medical practice, but I'll tell you that there was far more similarities than there were differences, and I was very pleased to see that. If you've had an opportunity to review the guidelines that were distributed, you'll see that they are quite extensive, but all in accordance with regulations. So you could very well be asking, if there's really nothing new in the regulation, why the new guidelines? And over the next 20 minutes or so, I hope to answer that question for you, talk about moving them forward and what results you might want to be looking for. There's two points that I probably should make first. My focus is really on the medical director guidelines, and the reason is simple. Perfecting this role and responsibility is the precursor to the attending guidelines. The second point that I must make, as it impacts everyone in terms of implementation of the guidelines, is that we're all at different starting point. The models in place for medical direction are varied, and the level of engagement or involvement runs the full gamut. So the guidelines do not dictate a preferred model, but place emphasis on advancing the role of the medical director and of the attending physician staff. I'll also tell you what I'm going to talk about. Why do this, getting started and seeing the results? It's not complicated. It's really more about commitment and focus. If we go to slide 32, in order to find a starting point, it's rather obvious that you might need to gauge where you are currently with your medical director relationship. I put a few questions out for consideration, and it's really an open book test. And the reason for posing these questions is for you to put objective measure around the idea that wherever you are on the medical director engagement, there's likely room to move forward. Written qualifications are a great place to start, and that's the first question. As you can see in the guidelines, the responsibilities contained within regulation go well beyond those of a practicing physician. If you don't have a physician description, that may be the starting point. Quality improvement is one of the most important areas where the medical director can have a strong participation level. Asking a few questions related to the level of involvement beyond attending the mandatory four meetings per year may give you some idea of where you are and where you may want to go. It's an interesting question also that was posed, and that's a schedule for administrative services from your medical director. How many hours are they, and how are they really being used? Going to slide 33, one of the most interesting questions to start off with, and probably could have been the first one presented, is the original date on your medical director's contract. Although the real regulatory emphasis has been on the medical director responsibilities before OBRA 87, but certainly since then, today's environment, from survey to resident characteristics and clinical needs to consumer expectations, they're just far different than they were a few decades back. And has your contract been kept current? And finally, a question about the peer review and credentialing. How active is this important function? And I pose the question about the retrospective and concurrent chart reviews in terms of a peer review process. Going to slide 34, so implementing the guidelines will be as unique as your circumstances are. If you're satisfied with the responses to those questions or similar questions that you might have identified, then you may have already moved ahead in terms of medical direction and expectations of this role. But if you're not all that satisfied and find perhaps that the facility medical director relationship is not where it ought to be or not consistent with today's environment, there may be reason to try something just a little bit different in order to change the result. Going to slide 35, in case there's any lingering doubt now about whether the time is right to move the guidelines into action, I thought it worthwhile to point out a few obvious, compelling reasons. And they're listed out on the slide, and I would look at these issues as falling into two primary categories. One is survey emphasis. From a provider standpoint, that's rather important. And comparing the FTAG standards to the medical director's required role, as you know, there's a lot of crossover. Also important is the quality of life emphasis, which falls under the coordination of care. 7 out of the top 10 QIS deficiencies as of December relate to areas which the medical director shares responsibilities, and this runs the full gamut from care planning to the use of unnecessary drugs. The second category of reason is the unnecessary hospitalizations, and having the medical director involvement in reducing returns to the hospital may go right to the operational imperatives that we all have in maintaining occupancy and keeping our residents out of the acute care setting to the degree that we can. Jumping to slide 36, just to move us forward, as you might have guessed, the first and best step is to actually read and understand the guidelines. Seems kind of obvious. And you'll see that there is regulatory reference as well as some plain language narrative within it. I'm not going to go through the guidelines on the pages, but I would draw your attention to page 8 of the medical director when you can. It points out the four primary roles and the more detailed functions and tasks as well. And the roles are physician leadership, patient care and clinical leadership, quality of care, and education and communication. And the tasks that follow are very tangible descriptions of carrying out each of those functional areas. And as you can see, each of those areas are described in a way that requires collaboration with the facility staff, the administration, with other medical staff, and will not be fully successful without the support of all of those people. It's a very collaborative model, and the medical director guidelines are written that way. The second step on slide 37, and again, not a complicated approach to implementation, is to conduct an honest appraisal of your current structure and how it's working for you. And this goes beyond the questions that I first raised a few minutes ago. This should be a collaborative approach after each of the key individuals has reviewed the standards, the guidelines, and can begin the process of identifying exactly where you're heading. Again, each organization is going to be different, but this review should focus not only on the medical director performance, standards, position description, but also on the facility practices that might impede performance, such as lacking a position description or a current agreement. Other facility practices that may become involved are as simple as scheduling, such as QI meetings. Can the medical director even get there? The relationships between the medical director and the key staff, such as the DON or nurse managers, or the actual amount of time allocated or dedicated to the administrative requirements of the medical director. Going to slide 38, in an ideal world, once you've carefully reviewed and gotten into the detail of the guidelines and then come up to a common understanding of where you are, the easiest part should be to simply line these two points up and set about your way to close the gap. But then again, here we are in reality, and as we are all at different points in our medical director relationship, moving this information you have collected into the next step of creating objectives will be very unique to your own circumstances. There may be consideration of available resources such as compensation, actual time available, the available skill sets and expertise, and determining the reasonable distance that you can reach between where you are right now and where you think you ought to be. The important thing here, and again, sound obvious but essential, is to establish some agreeable objectives. And I would say they may be as modest as updating the credentialing process and QI participation, or more advanced in agreeing to conduct a full review of all the functional areas between those groups, the medical director, DON, administrator. What might become very clear is that the objective should not fall all to the medical director, and that the facility itself will have some areas to address. If the existing facility practices create a barrier or to fail to promote advancing the medical director role, they need to be addressed in a priority fashion. Going to slide 39, moving backwards just a little bit, in the last year in discussing the guidelines, and as Dr. Dooley commented on, there was recognition that resources invested will have some relationship to the expected or achievable outcome. Whether the medical director is a full-time or part-time position, the ability to recruit and compensate a physician with the experience and credentials desired, and the financial commitment made by the facility all may play a role in the ability to achieve certain objectives. However, it was also clear during our discussions that achieving your desired objectives should not be dictated by these factors. And a high-performing and dedicated physician and focused facility effort may be equally effective in moving forward with meaningful change, as well, if not better, than a full-time medical director who does not have that supportive environment. Ultimately, you're going to have to reconcile whether your investment is achieving your desired result. And I just pose the three obvious questions that are you investing too little compared to what you want, or are you spending too much for what you're getting? Somewhere there has to be a balance between what you can invest or what you will invest and what your result is going to be. Slide 40, I want to say finally it's really time to dust off that medical director contract. And whether you do this after your objectives are established and you have a collaborative environment in motion, or as a very first step, it should be expected that the contract that you have, this business relationship, clearly defines the medical director role and the facility and administrative role. As the guidelines are based in regulation and the medical director relationship is established around regulation, it may make sense to actually adopt the guidelines formally, if not in reference at least, to assure continual movement towards a higher achieving higher performance. So I would suggest that you do view that contract as any other service contract and be sure that the facility responsibilities and medical director responsibilities are very clear, very measurable, achievable, and consistent with the expectations. Going to slide 41. I want to, at minimum, talk about what you should expect, and I'll take a page way out in history of Stephen Covey's language with beginning with the end in mind, and I would look at these as the key areas of focus. Each of these four areas are found throughout the guidelines. They're based on regulation and have very measurable standards with which to base your action plan. They have easy-to-apply before and after content, even if considered to be satisfactory at present. The active engagement of the medical director can and should positively impact each one. And going through quickly, the overall medical care, you have survey history, you have satisfaction scores, very objective. These are areas that should, this is one area that really should have an area of focus and a positive outcome. Physician oversight, the peer review, the visit compliance, the physician performance, again, all measurable today. And I would add in there also the physician performance also with relationships to the key clinical staff. How are those relationships functioning? The credentialing. I said consistent, critical, and compliant. And what I mean by that is the process is consistent over time. And the critical nature of it is it should be a degree that it's a critical test. It's a test of the physician in order to recredential. And is it compliant with your policies and regulation? Again, these are all measures you can look at today and determine whether or not your outcome, your areas of focus are going to, you want them to improve. Finally, quality improvement. Say present and accounted for. Being present is the easy part. The accounted for is different. I mean accounted for meaningful engagement year-round beyond those four meetings. Is that present today? What's the degree? And what do you hope to achieve from that? Slide 42, I want to move beyond the objective and regulatory-driven outcomes because there's others that will flow along, and these were mentioned in some of Dr. Dooley's slides as well, different wording, but as an editorial comment, the early steps of the process used to develop these really was an exercise in which the old and the new models were contrasted, and the old model identified many negative attributes associated with medical care in the nursing home and the perspective of physician practice. The new model, however, was really based on outcome, quality, resident-centered care, and identified all these common themes. These same themes were identified in the literature as having positive outcomes under a collaborative and effective medical director-facility relationship. The physician engagement and their satisfaction with the work that they're providing within your facility. The communication, which has been discussed. That accountability, which again has been discussed, but there's a shared sense of responsibility and accountability. The resident care and quality outcomes and how engaged all the parties are in those. And finally, the attending physician compliance through establishing very clear expectations of what their role is in the facility. And moving finally to slide 43, this brings us back to where I started off. And the guidelines do reflect well-defined roles, specific regulations, and identifying an organizational culture that values quality and outcomes. And how well a facility can put those three into a common perspective will really determine how far you can take these guidelines into the daily operation and practice. And I came in under my time frame. I'm very pleased to say that, and I will turn the discussion back to Michelle. If Michelle is on the call.
Yes, I'm here. Sorry, Andy, I was muted. I was talking and you guys couldn't hear me. At this time, we'd like to open for questions. Please direct your questions to a specific presenter for them to answer it for you.
If you do have a question, please press the number 1 on your phone one time. If your question was already answered, hit the number 1 to remove yourself from the queue. At this time, there are no questions.
Thank you, Beth, Pat, and Andy, for sharing your knowledge with us today. As our presenters have shared with you, the ultimate goal of the medical direction guidelines is to improve the way that providers and physicians work with each other and to improve the overall quality of medical care provided in nursing facilities in New York State. We encourage you to use the guidelines to evaluate your current culture of medical practice and as a roadmap to assist you in making any improvements that may lead to exceptional medical care for all of your residents. Thank
Michelle,
you to all.
Michelle, just before we end, I just want to make sure people had enough time to be able to queue into the system or think about a question before we close off. Operator, are there any other?
There's still no questions.
Okay.
Okay, if we have no further questions, and again, I'd like to thank all of our participants for participating in today's session. For additional information about the Empire Quality Partnership or Advancing Excellence, please contact any of the Empire Quality Partnership lead staff. The contact information is available on the last slide of your presentation. We also invite you to visit our website at www.empirequality.org. As a reminder to our participants, please complete the seminar evaluation form and fax it to the number at the bottom of the form. The evaluation is important to the development of future quality programs. This concludes today's session. Have a wonderful day.